Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we had a little glitch and a late start here, but let's just jump right into this week's show here. Want to talk about an update to some of the key trends going on in the global economy, but I also want to pick up where we left off last week. Started to talk about this theme that I want to elaborate on a little bit more here, called ideology in mainstream economics, how it works. We kind of rushed through that a little bit, and I want to talk about that a little bit more and give you a couple examples of some of the more popular ideological elements in mainstream economics. We talked about some of the themes, ideological themes, but I want to talk about this thing called the Phillips curves and the Laffer curve. And these are very popular in academic economics. All undergraduates are taught about the Phillips curves and Laffer curves, and they're not just for academic instructional purposes, but they are also the basis of some pretty significant economic policy that has major consequences for the economy and for income inequality and other elements of how the economy performs and who benefits from it and who doesn't. In other words, they are ideological, but ideology justifies the policy. And there's a close relationship between policy and ideology because the policy uses the ideology for a justification and political support for it, both among legislators and among the public. So it's ideology, but it's not, it's real. Okay. Now, ideology, I don't mean some ism. You know, I don't mean conservatism or liberalism or any kind of ism. Ideology is about misrepresentation of ideas. Misrepresentation. You know, all ideas represent reality to some extent, some better than others. Right? Some approximate. Some ideas approximate the real world closer than others. And better reflect, in other words, more accurately reflect reality. So they represent, all ideas represent. Ideas are not exactly congruent with reality, but they come closer or not so close. All right. So what do we mean by ideology? We mean the misrepresentation of ideas, and not just by accident or error. I mean, that's acceptable, you know, but conscious, purposeful, intentional misrepresentation of the real world. In other words, playing of language games in order to change the meaning of ideas or original ideas, to distort the meaning, to reinterpret the meaning, to fundamentally change the meaning of an idea. Now, ideas may be facts, they may be data, they may be arguments, logical arguments and claims about the relationships between certain variables and elements in an idea. They may be propositions. Ideas may be propositions. Propositions are more fully developed relationship or combinations of relationships between facts and variables and arguments. So proposition is a more robust idea. And when you put these various propositions together, you get to a higher level of theories, of causal relationships. And if the theories can predict, well, then you have models, predictive models of theories. Okay, so you can get more complex from simple facts and data to argument to propositions to theories and so forth. These are all ideas of degrees of complexity of ideas. Now, ideology distorts, falsely represents and reinterprets and changes the meanings, the original intentional meanings of ideas. And it does this with certain techniques, certain language techniques to change the meanings, to distort, to reinterpret, right, to change the relationships and so forth. And that's what we started talking about a little bit last week. Well, I want to return to that and talk about some of these language techniques. And in relationship to these two very contemporary, popular for decades now, ideas, theories, whatever, that distort reality, that do not really represent it, are represented only partially or temporarily. And they are represented in this idea of the Laffer curve, which has to do with taxes and investment, and the Phillips curve, which has to do with relationship between employment and wages and inflation. In other words, the Laffer curve and the Phillips curve are examples of ideological manipulation that is not just an academic exercise, but ideological manipulation that has major, major consequences for economic policy that affects real people in a massive way. Okay. All right. So ideology, once again, to recap, you know, is conscious, purposeful, intentional misrepresentation of ideas by using language games and manipulating certain techniques. And it's done on behalf of certain interest groups. That means that there's an institutional apparatus in the media, in think tanks and academia and other sources that actually is the place where ideology is created. And then from there, it gets incorporated into policy legislation. Right. Okay, so what are some of these techniques before we get on to describing how they work in the cases here of Laffer curves and Phillips curves? Well, as I said very quickly last week, there is, you know, at least seven or eight observable techniques of language games that are used. One is called inversion. What is that? That's where the basic relationships between the variables in an idea or a theory, right, are rearranged. The causal relationships between the variables and the ideas within a broader idea, for example, are inverted. Inverting the basic relationships between primary and secondary elements within a proposition. You see, a proposition is a complex idea full of facts and causal effects, assumptions between variables, and some are more important than the other. Others in a proposition, depending on its complexity. And, some of the arguments and ideas are more primary than others. Well, then, inversion is you take secondary, less important ideas, and you make them primary, and you either ignore or delete another technique, a primary relationship between variables in a proposition. Another technique is a reversal, changing the direction of cause and effect relationships between the ideas or basic propositions within an idea. Reversal, cause and effect, right? Instead of taxes being created, tax revenues created by raising taxes, you have the claim that no, it's just the opposite. It's tax cuts that create revenues. Instead of raising taxes to create revenues, you cut taxes to create revenues, right? That's a real reversal here of the cause and effect relationship that can be observed in the real world. In other words, you ignore the observation and you make the opposite cause and effect claim based upon the observation, because cause and effects have correlations, but not all correlations have cause and effect. Right? Okay, insertion, another technique. Introducing forward and often contradictory elements or propositions into an idea and thereby redefining it. Right? You may invent the insertion on the top of your head, right? Or you may take it from somewhere else, from another idea, and insert it into your new idea to distort the meaning, to change the meaning. You see, oh, it's always about changing the meaning. The techniques are all designed to change the original meaning of an idea or a proposition. Right? Conversion, as I said a second ago, declaring or interpreting correlations as cause and effect relationships. Deletion, in other words, removing a fundamental element of the idea altogether from the original idea. That's the opposite of insertion. Insertion is putting something that was totally foreign into the idea. Deletion is taking something that is fundamentally part of the idea and getting rid of it. And then we have to recap a little bit here, the relationships between cause and effect, reversing them or claiming a correlation is a cause and effect. Substitution, deleting and inserting fundamentally new elements into the propositions. That's related to insertion, but they're a little bit different, right? Merging two previously contradictory ideas into something new. That's the difference between substitution and insertion, right? And then finally, what I call detemporization, eliminating dynamic elements from the idea, creating a sense that the idea is forever fixed and timeless. In other words, dehistoricizing the idea, making it timeless and true in all cases, in all places, at all times. That's eliminating the time element to it and claiming it's always true everywhere. And then finally, what I call universalization, redefining the particular as the general, and the partial as the whole, as the temporary as the permanent. All right, so the last two are kind of time elements to the whole process. Those are just some of the observable techniques, inverting, reversing, inserting, converting, deleting, substituting, universalizing, that are used by ideologists who are people whose job it is to come up with ideologies to justify policies. Again, ideology is always conscious. Purposeful, intentional. It's not simply making an error and misrepresenting reality. It's consciously, purposely, intentionally misrepresenting reality. Right? That's a big difference between just making errors that don't reflect reality very well and doing it on purpose, right? Okay, so these are the techniques of ideological misrepresentation. How do they work here in these two example cases of Laffer curves, right? What do we mean? What's a Laffer curve? Laffer. Well, it's named after this business economist, Arthur Laffer, whose whole claim to fame was to create this curve. And it wasn't by accident he created the curve. He worked for think tanks in the late 70s, and the whole purpose was to come up with a justification for the push being made in the late 1970s to create Reaganomics, or what is sometimes called neoliberal economics or neoliberal policies. All right, one of the main elements of neoliberalism is that business tax cuts create jobs. Well, always create jobs everywhere. Every time you get a business tax cut, it will create jobs. You know, it's universal. It's ahistorical. It will happen. It's not true. Business tax cuts do not necessarily create jobs. And in the present period, very little jobs are created by business tax cuts. But the whole idea is, the misrepresentation here is actually to reverse the historical evidence going way back in economics, even back to Adam Smith, that argued that, the way to get businesses to create jobs is to raise taxes, and that would force them to be more productive, more creative, and come up with new ways of doing things cheaper and better, and in the process of creating new technologies, create new jobs, right? That was the original meaning, going back in economics to the classical period, of the relationship, the causal relationship between tax cuts and job creation. Well, with neoliberalism and Reagan, we've gotten just the opposite argument, that business tax cutting creates jobs. And every tax cut bill since Reagan of any consequence has always been named a Jobs Creation Act, even though there's little evidence of a direct causation. There may be correlations between tax cuts in a certain period and job creation, but that doesn't mean there's a causation, that it's the tax cuts themselves that created the jobs. And that's what's really, really important, the causal relationship, not the correlation, because many, many things, many economic developments and conditions may create jobs, not just tax cuts. Okay, so Laffer, in 1978, drew this curve that, unfortunately, I can't draw it for you here on audio, but basically the Laffer curve shows that if you reduce the corporate tax rate and the investor tax rate, for the wealthy 1% and so forth that do most of the investing, if you reduce those tax rate, the personal income tax, the top personal income tax, and the corporate income tax, of course, when you reduce the tax rate, you're going to produce less revenues, right? Because you're not taxing at a higher rate. Well, the Laffer argument is that by reducing the tax rate, you will actually increase revenues, government revenues, tax revenues. Sounds a little bit contrary to reality. Reduce taxes and you get more tax revenue. Well, the Laffer argument was, if you reduce taxes, then it will, those tax cuts will be committed to expanding business investment, and the business investment activity will generate more taxes, both from business increasing their output now, and also from business hiring more workers to increase their output, so that more personal income tax will be created as well. So, the whole argument rests upon the assumption that reducing the tax rate will generate more tax revenue than you will lose from cutting the tax rate. But the assumption is that business cost savings will be diverted into real investment, and therefore job creation, and therefore economic activity, and therefore more tax revenue. Right? This rests upon the assumption of neoclassical economics that investment is driven by business retained earnings, profits, in other words. That's the assumption. Well, what's the factual reality? Well, the factual reality, particularly in the last several decades, is that retained earnings and profits do not generate most of the real investment. Real investment meaning in plant and equipment and output, real output, goods and services. 80% of retained earnings, corporate profits, do not go into investment anymore. Where do they go? Well, they go into financial asset investing. They go into stocks and bonds and derivatives and currencies that don't create jobs. Or the profits are hoarded, or even more of the total are being redistributed back to wealthy shareholders in the form of stock buybacks and dividend payouts. As we said many times on this show, the combination of stock buybacks and dividend payouts since 2010 through 2017 have totaled over $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. That's where the corporate profits are going when they're not being invested by corporations themselves into financial asset markets. You know, that's called portfolio investment in companies. And companies and large companies, you know, about a third of their total profits come from financial asset investing, not from making things and hiring people, because you don't need to hire people to invest in financial assets, you see. You're not making anything. You're just buying a paper. Well, you're not even buying paper. You're buying electronic entries now. So most of these profits, corporate profits, the lion's share by far, are going into financial markets or being distributed to shareholders or being just hoarded on their own balance sheets. And by the way, this year, it's pretty clear that we have a record level of buybacks and dividend payouts. We'll get to that a little bit more, but well over $1 trillion. You know, it averaged about $1 trillion for 7 years. This year, it's about $1.3 trillion or maybe more. Who knows, you know? Tremendous, tremendous. Well, it's not going into real investment and creating jobs. So the tax cuts, good example is the Trump tax cuts. A small part is going into real investment and job creation, but the massive, overwhelming lion's share is not going into that job creation. Well, people say, well, where are we getting all these jobs? Well, it may be from other forces that have nothing to do with the tax cuts. You cannot claim, unless you're doing ideologically, that the tax cuts, the $5 trillion in investor corporate tax cuts passed under Trump, are being totally directed into real investment. I mean, a good example, another piece of evidence of this, is in the first half of this year, U.S. multinational corporations are bringing back the profits that they hoarded offshore, so they didn't have to pay taxes on it. They're using, in the first half already, like $479 billion in stock buybacks of that repatriated money. Well, that's just proof it's going into financial asset markets, stock buybacks, and not going into creating real goods and services from more investment and so forth. Yeah, we got job creation, but it's not because of the tax cut. Not at all. By the way, most of that job creation is not making goods and services. I mean, goods, real asset investment, creating real goods. It's mostly services, which have nothing to do with the tax cuts. Okay, so this Laffer curve assumption that if you give business more money to keep, they'll invest it in real assets and expand jobs and so forth, and that will be more tax revenue. There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence whatsoever of that, and there hasn't been since Reagan. Every time they pass a tax cut, they claim it's a Jobs Creation Act. Well, that's ideology, you see, because if you look at the argument, the techniques are very clear, right? We're reversing the cause-effect relationship between tax cuts and government revenue, and tax cuts and real asset investment, right? We're reversing those relationships, or we're inserting foreign ideas that were never there in the original relationship. We're inverting. We're changing the basic relationships between the variables. Mm-hmm. And we're claiming, by the way, detemporizing, saying that this is true in all times and all places. It's universal. Mm-hmm. It's always true. It always happens. Tax cuts create jobs. And therefore, greater revenue, greater economic activity, and greater revenue. When the reality shows, one, the tax cuts are not going into real asset investment. They're going into buybacks and financial asset investment, stock buybacks. By the way, just as an aside, you know, until Reagan neoliberalism, it was illegal for businesses to buy back their stock. Yeah, because the feeling was this would distort financial asset markets and would cause businesses, talking about big corporations and investors, to divert their capital from creating real things, expanding real goods, and that requires job creation, right? It would divert businesses just buying back their stock and playing in financial asset markets. In other words, it would divert the real investment into financial asset investment. That was the concern before Reagan. Well, Reagan came along and got rid of that, right, and allowed businesses to invest in stock buybacks, which is what they're doing very clearly. And it's driving up the stock market, keeping it up there artificially. You know, if you look at the U.S. stock market, it's very few corporations that are really tech and few others that are leading the whole stock artificial boom here going on. And it's not broad-based, you know, and it's artificially promoted here, the stock market, being held up by a few corporations on massive stock buybacks, trillions of dollars. Right, of buying their own stock, so it's totally artificial, and that artificial subsidization of stocks, financial assets, is making investors incredibly rich. You see, financial assets investing is the source of the big profits here in the last few decades, of course that's a big cause of the inequality trends that have been going on. Okay, so the Laffer curve, engages in reversal inversion and detemporization and other techniques here to consciously, intentionally create the theory that business tax cuts will stimulate real investment and therefore GDP and job creation, right? That's the ideological argument, not substantiated by the facts, but it makes for a good way to sell, legislators in Congress to sell big tax cuts for the rich. It justifies it. You know, they buy everybody else's support by saying, well, it'll create jobs for you, you know. And the average American says, oh, okay, well, you can get rich as long as you create a job for me. Well, it's not creating the jobs, right? Certainly not jobs from real asset investment. The job creation that's going on is due to other factors, and it's also poor quality service, low-paid jobs, is not being driven by the tax cuts. All right, that's the Laffer curve. What's the Phillips curve? The Phillips curve is an idea that actually is originally, in its original form, substantiated by empirical facts, right? It did not start out as an ideological argument, right? Phillips, this British economist in the late 1950s, A.W. Phillips, looked at Britain between 1865 and 1950s, and he simply plotted changes in wages against changes in employment. And he got a downward sloping curve, hence called the Phillips curve. In other words, when employment was good, you didn't have unemployment. When employment was high, you know, workers would get higher wages, right? Well, that makes sense. Labor markets are tighter, and workers can negotiate higher wages, especially if you have unions. They can do that even better. So there was an inverse relationship between employment levels and wage change in industrial economies at the time. U.S. economists, Paul Samuelson and others in the 1960s, adapted that. In other words, they inserted new elements into that wage-employment relationship. And they said, instead of wages, we know wages are really the cause of inflation. Let's just change the axes on our graph here. And instead of wages, we'll call it inflation. And instead of employment, we'll call it unemployment. Right? So now we get a curve that's a relationship between inflation, prices, and unemployment, and we consider unemployment a proxy for GDP, another change that they made. So they're inserting here. We got insertion going on, prices for wages and GDP for unemployment. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you now have a relationship between inflation and economic growth, GDP. And, if growth picks up, you're going to have inflation, right? And if you want to bring prices, inflation down, then you slow down economic growth. Create unemployment, but slow it down. So you got a trade-off, right? Now, that relationship, like the Laffer relationship between tax cuts and tax revenues, this relationship was used by mainstream economists in the 50s and 60s to argue that you could fine-tune the economy, that if you wanted to have a little more inflation, well, you could stimulate the economy, and if you want to bring inflation down, you could slow the economy down. But underneath it was this idea that wages cause inflation. Well, to some extent, that may have been more due in the 1950s when you had stronger unions and you had oligopolies in business, so they could raise prices without worrying about foreign competition, right? But today, unions, particularly in a good sector, are almost defunct, right? And you don't have oligopolies in a national economy. You have a global economy. Good examples like the auto industry, right? The auto industry very clearly is global. Same with the steel industry and so forth. And there's a lot more competition going on between global capitalists. All right, so the problem here with the Phillips curve is that also it was assumed by liberal Keynesian economists that this would be true forever. There would always be a trade-off between inflation and growth, and there would be a trade-off between wages and inflation. Well, the assumption here, what's new, the insertion, is the assumption that wages cause inflation, you see, which isn't true, right? They're substituting as well. We have a substitution effect going on here, and Well, I wouldn't say there's a reversal of cause and effect. We've just changed the variables that we're looking at in terms of cause and effect. But we have inverted the basic relationships between wages under Phillips, wages and unemployment, and now we're talking about inflation and employment and GDP. Right? It's an example, right, of a change in the fundamental meaning of an idea. The big problem with Phillips' curve was that assuming it would always be true in the 1970s, it totally collapsed. You could not find anymore an inverse relationship between inflation and economic growth, right, or employment. You couldn't find it. It disappeared, right? It comes back sometimes, but it's certainly not universal. But the assumption was it was universal. That was one of the ideological elements associated with the Phillips curve. Now, the Phillips curve, in terms of policy, is important because it's the justification for the central bank engaging in raising interest rates or lowering interest rates in order to slow down inflation. You know, the central bank, the Fed, always says its target is a 2% inflation rate. We're talking about goods inflation, that for 7 years after 2009, the central bank, the Fed, kept interest rates of virtually zero. And the whole justification for zero interest rates for bankers, and not much more for businesses, was, we want to generate, get the economy going so we generate 2% inflation. Well, they kept for 7 years. Well, it had nothing to do with inflation. It had everything to do with subsidizing the banks and businesses with zero, near zero interest rates. In other words, they could borrow money from the Federal Reserve at virtually nothing. Actually, the Federal Reserve would pay them a quarter, 1% to borrow the money from them, the Fed. And then businesses would loan out, at a higher rate, particularly to multinational corporations that were expanding abroad. So it was really a form of subsidization, and it created, exacerbated income inequality because, you know, tens of millions of people, savings accounts and CDs and so forth, got no interest for 7 years. But the banks got all that free money for 7 years. So in a sense, all the retirees with CDs and savings accounts actually gave their money to the banks. Is what that transfer of income amounts to, right? The Phillips curve was a justification for the Fed and the central bank's policy. They even got to a point where the Fed would say, we got to lower the interest rate. Lower the unemployment rate in order to we're not just trying to get inflation up to 2%. We'll get it to 2% if we lower the unemployment rate. Well, they get the unemployment rate down to, less than 5%, and they still didn't do anything about it, right? And they even started talking about, what we're really about is getting wages up, but they never set a wage target, and wages still aren't getting up in real terms anyway. This idea of the Phillips curve, still embraced by the central bankers, the Federal Reserve. Still to this day, they believe this thing, right? Just as the right wingers, the pro, radical business people believe, give us more tax cuts, and we'll get the economy going, right? And there are all kind of techniques of justification of these assumptions that get translated into real policy. With the Phillips curve, it's techniques of insertion, conversion, reversal, etc. You know, we can go look at the same application of these techniques to all kinds of ideologies associated in mainstream economics, not just tax cuts create jobs or central banks target interest rates, right? That's just two of the many represented with theoretically with the Laffer curve and the Phillips curve. But we could talk about, other ideological themes in mainstream economics, you know, like free trade benefits everybody. You've heard that one, right? Yeah. Or income inequality is because workers aren't productive. If you want to eliminate income inequality, then let's make workers more productive. Let's make them go back to school. And if you were a steel worker for 30 years, you know, now you gotta learn to be a software developer. Ha ha. So those are some of the other themes. A lot of them bouncing around here, making believe that they're economic science. You know, parading as economic science when they're really economic ideology designed to misrepresent reality, to distort and change meanings, fundamental meanings based on empirical facts, to change them to justify policy initiatives that benefit certain interest groups. That's what ideology is about. Okay. Having said that, let's move back on to an overview of what's going on in the global economy here and what remains of the show. Okay. In recent weeks, we've been talking about Turkey and emerging markets. Well, what's happened the past week with Turkey and emerging markets? Right? Well, as we said last week, we got a crisis brewing in Turkey. But it's Turkey is just the tip of the iceberg in this whole thing. It's really emerging markets, emerging market economies. And it's really some very large emerging market economies like Argentina, Brazil, Indonesia, India, South Africa, and now China, which you know, may or may not be defined as an emerging market. It's certainly emerged. But what the problem in Turkey is the symbol, the symbolic evidence of it is this collapse of its currency. Turkey's currency is collapsing, down 40%. One time it dropped like 15% in one day. It's since stabilized a little bit here this past week as certain actions were taken by Turkey. One, Turkey refuses to raise its interest rate. The West is pressing Turkey to raise its interest rate, domestic interest rates. But if it does that, it's going to cause a deep recession or worse in Turkey. And politically, Turkey does not want to do that. But a couple things have happened over the past week to stabilize temporarily, because the fundamentals haven't changed, the collapse of its currency. What are some of those changes or developments in the past week? Well, one, they've allowed Turkey has allowed its banks to suspend what's called mark-to-market reporting. It's a fancy word for really saying you don't have to report your losses, banks, right? You can obfuscate them for now, right? You don't have to do mark-to-market, and you can suspend mark-to-market in the meantime. So it doesn't look like your banks are in such trouble, because if it looks like you're in such trouble, then owners of the bank stocks will start dumping the bank stocks, and that will make you in more trouble, you see. The currency problem in collapsing currency problem in Turkey is the reflection of the fact that Turkey has borrowed so much in dollar denominations from the West, particularly European banks. And that means that there's a contagion channel that exists between the Turkey crisis and Europe. The Bank of International Settlements here in Geneva has indicated recently that there's been $11.4 trillion in outstanding dollarized debt. In other words, Turkey is borrowing and borrowing in dollars. So if the dollar goes up, Turkey has to pay more for what it borrowed because it has to do it in dollars. And it has to do it with a currency that's collapsing in dollars. So it's a double hit, you see. You got to pay more and you got less to pay it with when your currency collapses and you owe it in dollars. Well, wait a minute. This is, you know, the connections with Europe. What does it have to do with dollars? Well, dollars the global currency, pretty much. And European banks have a lot of dollars. And if Turkey wants to borrow from them, they will loan them with the dollars that they have, that the European banks have. Okay? And dollars were pretty cheap for a long time. So Europe accumulated dollars, European banks. And because they were cheap, they would loan them to Turkey. Right? Well, you know, dollarized corporate debt. We're talking about non-financial corporations here. This isn't just bankers. Of course, if non-financial corporations don't pay their debt to bankers, then the problem becomes a banker's problem. But there were like $5.8 trillion in dollarized corporate debt outstanding in 2009, and is $11.4 trillion today. And $3.7 trillion of that has been loaned to emerging market economies, you know, at the forefront of which is Turkey. So the problem is of dollarized debt and collapsing currency and rising dollar is not just limited to Turkey. Turkey's the tip of the iceberg, you see. Other countries, particularly those in Latin America and Asia, who are also exposed, Argentina and its peso collapse, Brazil, real. And now in the last week, we're seeing greater pressure with the Indonesia rupiah currency and India's rupee currency. Those currencies, Indonesia rupiah, is now at its lowest value in 3 years. And the India rupee is now at a record low as well. In other words, it's been devaluing as the dollar goes up in value. Well, why is the dollar going up in value? As we said last week, it's going up in value because of rising interest rates in the U.S., which will continue to rise, right? And in the middle of this, of course, Trump, for domestic political purposes, is fanning the flames of the Turkish currency lira devaluation by threatening more and more tariffs if Turkey doesn't release this cleric here, U.S. cleric guy. Well, you know, that's Trump pandering to his evangelical base here, right? Trump will risk upsetting the global economy just to get reelected and reelect those that will support him in Congress. You see, he's willing to throw the whole global economy under the bus for his own domestic political purposes. You know, it really amazes me why the traditional elites in this country don't stop this guy. You know, he delivered on the big tax cut. You know, they're not going to kill the golden goose here. You know, this guy has delivered for them, too. As long as he's doing that, they'll tolerate him. You know, money first, we'll worry about the crisis later, is the attitude of the U.S. elites here, pretty much, a lot of them anyway. Well, Turkey has been trying to deal with this without raising interest rates and slowing its economy. Qatar, which is another Middle Eastern sheikdom there, is aligned with Turkey increasingly. And that's what's got Saudi Arabia all upset about Qatar and Egypt. And Qatar is throwing $15 billion into Turkey here to try to stabilize its currency, right? Also, limits on selling the lira, the currency there, have been instituted. And as I said, suspending mark-to-market economy, right? But Turkey is not going to raise interest rates, domestic rates, at least not yet, nor is it going to be pushed, as the U.S. and others are doing it, into the arms of the IMF, which will loan them money and give the U.S. that runs the IMF more control over Turkey's economy. So that's the battle going on there. But we have this contagion channel potential that needs to be watched closely, and that's the European banks, particularly, you know, not just the Italian banks. UniCredit, big Italian bank, is exposed to Turkey, but BNP Paribas in France and BBVA in Spain are also exposed to Turkey. So that could be a channel, contagion channel to watch. Of course, the other contagion channel is other global currencies that are already weak for these countries I mentioned that will go down even further as the Turkish lira gets in trouble here. I'm talking about India, South Africa, Indonesia, Argentina, Brazil, etc. And others coming behind it that are possibilities as well are, you know, Mexico, Philippines, Chile, Pakistan. They're all becoming financially unstable here. The currencies are becoming unstable. And as I wrote on my latest entry on my blog, jackrasmus.com, you know, will Trump fanning the flames and causing a further deterioration in tariff and trading relationships further exacerbate this currency downturn? Because the countries that are stuck with dollarized debt, you know, they've got to sell more exports. They got to sell more exports in order to pay the rising debt because of rising dollar, you see? And Trump knows this. He knows this. He knows all these countries that have engaged in dollarized debt, in other words, the dollar as a weapon of economic imperial control here, playing its role, right? He knows they're more exposed, and therefore he can squeeze them with rising rates and tariff threats and tariff actions. You know, it's all part of neoliberalism 2.0 and Trump's attempt to resurrect neoliberalism in the U.S. in a more virulent, aggressive form, aggressive vis-a-vis foreign capitalist competitors, whip them in place to follow us, them, U.S. capital, and also moves underway to tame domestic opposition. You know, whether it's the Democratic Party or the U.S. Bureaucracy or the U.S. media, you see, he's going after all these sources and taming them and getting them in line. In other words, breaking their power domestically, as well as he's going after global capitalist some of them aren't even adversaries. They were trading partners, right? Whip them in place. Make sure that the U.S. dominates for another decade globally, economically. That's what this is all about, you see. This is what neoliberalism 2.0 is all about. Go after your capitalist competitors and go after your domestic opposition. And both of those are being there's a strategy here that's being implemented by Trump. And if they don't stop him with this election coming up in November, then, you know, Katie bar the door, as they say, right? We got U.S.-China trade negotiations going on this week, and we'll see what happens there. Well, it makes it sound like it's a big deal, but this is very low-level people, window dressing on both sides here to try to calm the markets, you know. This is not real negotiations, right? And Trump is threatening 500 billion more tariffs, all tariffs on all Chinese goods, you know. We'll see what happens there. At the same time, we've got the European economy slowing, maybe 1% growth rate, and concern about Turkey, which is Europe's fifth largest export market. Italy threatening to break the fiscal budget limits in the EU. Confidence in manufacturing down sharply in Europe. And then we have, as the last comment here, we have the U.S. budget deficit now looking like it'll be $769 billion in the second half of this year. 763% over last year, right? Corporate tax revenues down $400 billion, defense spending up $100 billion, right? All of last year, the budget deficit was $666 billion. Now it's going to be well over $1 trillion this year. And what are businesses doing with the $400 billion tax cuts? Well, so far they spent $437 billion in stock buybacks. Okay, that's what's happening. All right, next week we'll talk about, I'm sure there'll be another crisis continuing that we'll have a lot to talk about. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Boys, that time.